This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the United States and Cuba reopen embassies for the first time, and El Chapo escapes again. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. After more than five decades of hostility, the United States and Cuba restored full diplomatic relations last Monday. On July 20, the red, white, and blue Cuban flag was hoisted at the State Department, alongside the flags of other countries with which Washington has diplomatic ties. There was an opening celebration also at Cuba's Washington embassy. The official events to inaugurate the American embassy in Havana will not take place until August, when Secretary of State John Kerry plans to visit. Many hope that the openings of embassies in Washington and Havana after more than 50 years, signifies a new era of bilateral relations, driven by engagement to increase regional stability and empower the Cuban people. But the question is, will the reestablishment of embassies enhance or undermine the Castro regime, which flouts human rights, maintains a closed political and economic system? The two governments remain deeply divided on a number of issues, including Cuba's demand that the United States lift its trade embargo and relinquish the naval base at Guantanamo Bay. And how is it that Joaquin Guzman, better known as El Chapo, the world's most notorious drug lord, escapes from a maximum security prison in Mexico? The prison break humiliated the government of President Enrique Peña Nieto, which had proclaimed the arrest of Mr. Guzman and leaders of other drug cartels as critical achievements in restoring order and sovereignty to his country, one long beleaguered by horrific violence associated with organized crime. Well, with us to discuss these and other issues are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. That's a Washington-based organization widely considered to be a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere, and Harold Trinkunas. He's a senior fellow and director of the Latin America Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, a think tank based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric Farnsworth, let me begin with you, talking about the embassy openings in Havana and Washington, a lot of fanfare here in Washington. We know that that will be delayed until August in Havana when Secretary of State John Kerry goes there to raise the American flag at a formal ceremony. But beyond the symbolism of this major policy shift that President Obama announced last year, what do these openings mean concretely?
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are trying to figure out right now. But let's not put the symbolism aside. I think the symbolism is important. It does show that both governments have outreach to each other. We can speculate in terms of the reasons, but the fact is that they have now found common cause and have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. And that is a sea change, and it is symbolically important. It is historic. And I think the question now is, as you accurately ask, what comes next? As the foreign minister of Cuba, Bruno Rodriguez, has said, now the real work begins, which is to say, okay, now we have embassies in place, we have diplomatic relations restored, that gives us the ability to talk to each other directly through channels, but now we have to begin to address some of the issues that really continue to divide both countries. And I don't think either government has suggested this will be an easy process, but simply to say that the process has now begun.
Turning to you, Harold Trinkunas, for your take on the opening of the embassies and what comes next.
Well, I have to agree with Eric that symbolism is important here. This is the end of a long period of contention between the two countries. I think it's an important signal in U.S. foreign policy towards the rest of the region. U.S. policy towards Cuba has been increasingly a bone of contention, an irritant for relations between many Latin American countries and the United States. It soured the summits of the Americas until the most recent one that just occurred in April in Panama. And in fact, in Panama in April, we saw the beginning, I think, of a change in tone in U.S. relations towards the region. It's seen as sort of the end of the Cold War in a certain way by many Latin American countries, really signaling the attitude that Secretary Kerry has been proclaiming of increased partnership and equal relations with other countries in the region.
Turning back to you, Eric Farnsworth, to what extent do you think the opening of the embassies, this whole process of eventual normalization, will actually enhance or undermine the Castro regime, which does flout human rights and maintains this closed political system? So many detractors here in the United States. We have a lot of opposition. To what extent do you think that there may be some possibility Or could it perhaps help him and help the regime maintain its repression?
Well, I think what the U.S. administration would suggest is that by opening up in this way, you allow people in Cuba itself to find their own voice, whether it's through the private sector and activities that they might be able to engage in, which they haven't been able to engage in to this point, or also to be able to have a direct communication with the government of Cuba to raise those issues of human rights and to raise those issues of concern to the United States.
For your take, Harold Trinkunas, whether or not this opening will actually enhance the ability of the Castro regime to continue its flouting of human rights? Or do you think, in fact, over time, as the Obama administration is hoping that the Cuban people themselves, that positive change can occur?
Well, I think that by and large, it's very difficult to predict the direction that this will take. But there are some markers I think we can look to. One is the rate at which economic activity by Cubans in the private sector, the so-called cuenta propista sector, or cooperatives, develops. To what extent does the ability of Cubans to provide for themselves expand rather than relying on the state? I think that's an important marker of economic freedom. We also know that Raul Castro has signaled that he's stepping down in 2018 and transitioning, presumably, to a younger generation. Those moments of transition are always moments of unpredictability. There may be greater opening associated with that going forward. And we also have to remember that Cuba is essentially part of a hemisphere in which many of the countries are democracies. And to the extent that this puts change between the United States and Cuba exposes Cubans to a wider array of views about how to conduct business, how to conduct government, how to conduct themselves in civil society, I think that can only expand the range of views within Cuba itself. So these elements together may produce change in the long run.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Playing the devil's advocates, detractors or opponents of this policy would say, you know, so what's the Cuban government giving the United States in return?
Well, I think that's a fair question to ask, but that assumes that they're doing this as some sort of a trade-off or some sort of a quid pro quo. And I think that that's a question that's open for debate. I think, again, if you talk to the U.S. administration, they will say the bottom line is to open up to provide an alternative model and an alternative source of perhaps influence on the island, again, through finding voice in the private sector and other entities to be able to affect change on the island. But whether that's giving up or gaining or losing, I mean, we get caught up in that debate, whether it's in Washington or frankly Havana or other places as well. And ultimately, that's not the real issue.
Indeed. And Harold Trinkunas, nonetheless, Cuba has made some concessions, some release of prisoners. You know, what have they done, even if that is not the core of why we're doing this?
Well, there's been some trade-offs in the sense on, you mentioned issues related to prisoners and treatment of prisoners. Some conversations have happened around telecommunications and possibility of expanding internet access. But I really don't think that the framing of this in terms of trade-offs really explains very much. This is really each country pursuing its own interests. The U.S. seeing an interest in changing a policy that hasn't worked and experimenting with a new policy that through an expanded array of communications, trade, travel, will bring more diverse views into the island. And the Cuban government, frankly, pursuing its own interests, the exhaustion of its economic model, the inability to achieve growth under current conditions, the weakening of its partnership with Venezuela as Venezuela enters a period of much more serious economic and political crisis. Venezuela is, after all, a major supplier of oil to Cuba. And the Cubans are looking around, seeing that the previous model and their previous allies are no longer as helpful as they used to be, and they had to try something new.
We'll take a short break and be right back.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Back to Encounter. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Harold Trinkunas, Senior Fellow and Director of the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution. We're talking about the opening of embassies in Cuba and the United States. Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. What about the embargo, talking about private sector and the ability of that to produce liberalization in Cuba? This embargo is a major sticking point. Talk about the trade embargo and how this will continue to hamper normalization. And what are the prospects of it being lifted and when?
Well, the embargo is a part of U.S. law and can only be overturned by the U.S. Congress. And so, yes, it is a sticking point in the context of the bilateral relationship. There's no question about that. And for many years, the Castro government has asked that it be changed, lifted. It was originally put on because of property claims issues in Cuba. And so this is an example of another issue that's of great consequence in the bilateral relationship. It shows that just by opening an embassy and raising the flags, as important and symbolic as that may be, this does not resolve all of the pending issues between the two governments. And I think you are hearing now, for example, private sector entities in the United States and elsewhere saying, look, we want to have the ability to engage more actively in Cuba. And people in Congress are listening to that. There is an increasingly active role in that context. But having said that, it's a highly political issue. This is Washington. We have a political campaign that will begin shortly. In fact, it's already begun in terms of the presidential politics. And so that will play into it too. So this is another one of those issues that I think watchers will be looking at very carefully, very closely, but it does speak to the issue of timing and how long it will take. And I'm not saying it will be a long time, but it's not overnight in the context of changing fundamentally the relationship.
Back to you, Harold Trinkunas. Now, these executive orders that have opened the way for normalization certainly do allow more trade, some limited trade, correct?
Absolutely. Some expanded trade, some expanded travel as well. So there is expanded opportunities to interact with the island, but there are some genuine limits on trade that will require change in legislation, not just executive action. And in fact, I think what we're starting to see is a development of constituencies, or the more active voice by constituencies in the United States, that see the possible competition from other countries around the world, perhaps Europe, perhaps Canada, other Latin American countries such as Brazil, and getting involved in Cuba before them in a certain sense. So I think that this will be part of the dynamic from the private sector in pressing for change.
And we're going to have more on the political impediments to lifting the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, a nonprofit group based here in Washington and considered a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere, and Harold Trinkunas, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Latin America Initiative in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and we're discussing the future of U.S.-Cuba relations as embassies in both countries reopen for the first time in over 50 years. And later, how did El Chapo, the most notorious drug lord, break out of jail? This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout out to Uzma Amir from Islamabad, Pakistan. Back to you, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about the impediments to lifting the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba. And of course, you brought up the fact that this is an inherently political issue. And that leads me to ask you about the nature of the political opposition in this country. In fact, U.S.-Cuba policy has historically been more of a domestic political issue because of the importance of the state of Florida in national elections, the large Cuban-American vote. No self-respecting presidential candidate wants to run afoul or risk votes by favoring, at least in the past now, resumption of ties with Cuba and etc. But we know that this bloc isn't so monolithic anymore. Talk about, you know, within the Cuban-American community, how their feelings or positions vis-a-vis this opening are breaking down.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Over time, you do have a change in demographics in terms of generational changes, in terms of geographical changes. And the issue in terms of Cuba policy in the United States, you correctly say, in my view, that it's fundamentally a domestic policy. The people who have wanted to restrict relations are very passionate about that, whereas those who perhaps are on the other side are more diffuse. And so there's an issue in politics of passion and interest and therefore the commitment to a certain issue. Well, that may be changing a little bit as we see a new generation arise without the same contact with the island originally, without perhaps the same connections or viewpoints. And that's something that we would anticipate. And it's borne out by polls, whether it's in Florida or whether it's across the United States. You do tend to have much more of an accepting attitude and a willingness and a desire to engage with Cuba. And we've seen that across all kinds of different groups. And I think that's being borne out now in the policy as well.
Turning back to you, Harold Trinkunas, to the extent that the U.S.-Cuba policy has been more of a domestic political issue over the years, and to the extent that we see the demographics changing within the Cuban-American community, more younger people are perhaps more open to normalization. But to what extent do you think over time, you know, this might change and then change U.S. politicians' views and perhaps lead toward a lifting of the embargo?
Well, I think that we have to keep in mind that after the initial announcement was made in December last year by Presidents Obama and Castro, the reaction was perceived as surprisingly positive by many in the administration and many observers of the issue. In fact, there wasn't as much negative political reaction in the United States. I think what we're seeing now, and especially in the Republican Party, because of primary season coming up, typically voters in that process tend to skew more conservative. Politicians are likely to be a little bit more careful about the issue. I think once we get to the general election, we'll get a better idea of how it plays. But even so, let's keep in mind a couple of things. One is that even if we look back at previous episodes of sort of warming of U.S.-Cuban relations that occurred during the Carter administration, that led to the creation of the interest section in Washington and Havana to provide diplomatic representation. The Reagan administration didn't roll that back. They actually found it useful to have a somewhat more open relationship. And who knows, a future administration may find the same thing in the United States. The second point I would make is that we have to remember there's people in Cuba who are also concerned about the pace of liberalization. And in fact, Raul Castro, at a speech at the Summit of the Americas, made the point of addressing people back home that to say that he also needed to find support within the Cuban state and Cuban bureaucracy for this program of normalization of relations with the United States. So this is domestic politics on both sides.
Absolutely. And of course, the big debate will be within Cuba. Well, let's turn now to this incredible escape by El Chapo, this drug lord. Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Really, this is not just the first time. This is the second time. And this is after the Mexican president said that this would not happen at a time when the United States was even asking for his extradition. And how is it that he was under 24-hour surveillance and still he escaped? How can they explain this?
I don't think you really can. I mean, it's deeply embarrassing to the Mexican government. It's been harmful to the bilateral relationship in terms of U.S. and Mexican law enforcement. And it wasn't just the fact that he escaped, but the brazenness with which it occurred, which is to say, mile-long tunnel that was air-conditioned, lighted, and served by a motorcycle on a track. I mean, this is remarkable. And the engineering of the tunnel itself was also quite advanced. In other words, it's really difficult to put a mile-long tunnel anywhere in the ground and have it come up precisely underneath a shower stall in a prison. You have to have precision instruments. You have to have talented engineers to be able to do this. It's not just something where you can dig a hole and hope to hit the ground, hit the right place in the prison. So there was obviously a lot of outside help. There was probably some inside help too, one has to speculate, and I think that the Mexican government itself has gone that direction. They've already begun to investigate and dismiss some people who have been accused of complicity, if not outright support for the effort. And I think that's going to continue. But I think the bigger question is one of rule of law in Mexico. Look, this is the number one prisoner in all of Mexico that the president himself has said would never escape, and this is an indicator of Mexico's commitment to the rule of law, and the fact is now he has escaped, and he's escaped from a maximum security prison with 24-hour surveillance. So a number of folks would suggest that, okay, this might be one scenario here, but the broader question across Mexico remains. And that's one of rule of law. It's one of the ability to not just bring people to justice, but then to implement justice. And the ability of a government to actually put out a vision and then to be able to live by that vision so that it's not just the well-connected or the wealthy or in this case the criminals who have access to the levers of power, but frankly it's all of the Mexican citizens. And I think until these fundamental questions are asked and answered within Mexico, as indeed in elsewhere in Latin America, you're going to have a continued question about how far and how developed a country like that can become.
Turning to you, Harold Trinkunas, what do you think are the implications for the rule of law in Mexico and for President Enrique Peña Nieto as a result of this unbelievable escape by El Chapo? And what are the implications for U.S.-Mexican relations?
Well, it is quite an implausible story. If you'd seen this played out in a Hollywood movie, you would probably have thought that the producers and writers were overreaching. But it's certainly a remarkable escape. But from the perspective of Mexican citizens, it's going to be seen as one more piece of confirming evidence that President Peña Nieto's security strategy is simply not working. We have to remember that President Peña Nieto campaigned on a platform of reform, reform of the state across a number of different areas, including security. Mexican citizens were quite tired of the levels of violence that had been reached under the previous government in the war on drugs, and we're looking for a different answer. And in fact, President Peña Nieto really didn't deliver on that.
Anything to add or subtract, Eric, with respect to what's going on between Mexico and the United States with respect to trying to capture El Chapo, and what are the implications going forward?
Well, clearly there's law enforcement cooperation that's going on every day between the two countries, but this was a highly symbolic case and also a cause celebre for many in the U.S. law enforcement community, because this is the guy who has been responsible for a large percentage, an overwhelming percentage, of illegal drug trafficking into the United States. So having him behind bars for a good long time was really something that U.S. law enforcement was quite interested in doing. So I think it will cause a little bit of, it is causing a lot of concern, but it will also cause some questioning about the nature of that cooperation and what can they do differently to make sure something like this never happens again.
Harold Trinkunas, what do you think can be done differently to make sure that this doesn't happen again? What's going to change between the United States and Mexico as a result of this?
Well, I think that there's a possibility that the U.S. and Mexico will actually find a way to collaborate more closely. In fact, the Peña Nieto administration had dialed back U.S.-Mexico law enforcement collaboration from the point where it had reached during the previous two administrations in Mexico. But ultimately, it's the Peña Nieto government that needs to change its own policies. They've really put security on the back burner for most of the administration while they focus on other areas of reform. And this is really just highlights the fact that Mexico needs to conduct police reform, judicial reform, penitentiary reform, with the prospects of creating a more effective rule of law complex within the country. And that's something that ultimately the Mexicans themselves are going to have to do. The U.S. ability to help with that is actually relatively limited, even if there's goodwill.
And as we close, let's turn now to U.S.-Brazilian relations. Eric Farnsworth, President Dilma Rousseff was here meeting with President Obama not too long ago, but she is under some severe attack, lots of corruption scandals in the country that are starting to reach her office. What's the situation in Brazil, and how would you characterize U.S.-Brazilian relations?
Well, I think the U.S.-Brazil relations are actually quite strong, and the purpose of her coming to Washington at the end of June was to highlight the fact that the relations are back on track after the Snowden scandal, and to emphasize that there's a broad agenda that both governments now feel comfortable pursuing. The irony here is that just as she was being celebrated in Washington, now she returns to Brasilia to find corruption scandals swirling around her, an economy that's in real trouble. Their top trade partner, China, is growing, but not nearly as fast as in the past. Other trade partners are also languishing, and she's got some real political issues with the Congress that didn't previously exist. So her own domestic political situation has become a lot more complicated. And so the question then becomes, will all the goodwill and all the things that may have been agreed bilaterally in Washington, what are the prospects that those will actually be implemented going forward? Because she's got to spend a lot of time now protecting her political flanks in Brazil and shoring up her own position, and that's going to take some time and effort. There's a lot swirling around it right now.
And the last word to you, Harold Trinkunas, what was the takeaway from the recent meeting between Dilma Rousseff and Barack Obama? And to what extent will her increasingly difficult political situation back home negatively affect her ability to fulfill any kind of agreements that may have been made?
I think beyond even the issue of political corruption scandals at home, Rousseff faces a very difficult economic situation. And what we've seen since she took office earlier this year is an effort to move back towards orthodoxy, economic orthodoxy in terms of market reforms, greater interest in reforms in trade, greater interest in getting closer to the United States. And so this is part of what she's signaling as a way of saying that Brazil is returning to sort of tested and true policies that will help it get ahead. The political corruption situation, though, really means that she has very little capital with which to advance these policies going forward, especially as her allies in Congress begin to desert her, as has started to happen over the past month. So there's goodwill on both sides. The U.S. is signaling that it supports an expanded relationship with Brazil. We'll have to see if President Rousseff can really follow through.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Harold Trinkunas. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Gracias for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.